From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. When it comes to public colleges and universities, more students generally mean more money. States fund schools based on how many students they enroll. But economic pressures are changing that as states consider the bottom line. NPR's Larry Abramson went to Tennessee and brought us this story on efforts to peg funding to the number of students who actually graduate with a degree.
The food court at Tennessee Technology University in Cookeville is bright and airy. Students can pick which music video they want to watch while they eat. It isn't hard to lure students to colleges like this one. What's difficult is getting them to graduate. Only about half the students at Tennessee Tech will get a degree within 6 years from this school. The rest will transfer or drop out. Until now, Tennessee Tech had no financial incentive to do anything about that, says Richard Rhoda, executive director of the State Higher Education Commission.
The old model was built at a time when resources were more available, the incentive was out there for the institutions to grow.
As budgets grow tighter, Tennessee is realizing it needs better returns from its investment in education. So last year, the state passed the Complete College Tennessee Act. College funding will rise and fall depending mostly on the number of students who graduate. Tennessee Tech's $35 million in state funding this year will go up or down based solely on whether students are succeeding. The initiative is only about a year old, but it's already getting attention where it matters. This used to be the library at Tennessee Tech, but the school decided that many of the books could go elsewhere. It was more important to renovate this space and turn it into an inviting learning commons. Now it's full of students working together at tables.
It is much more flexible in its use, and I think student traffic is up considerably.
Paul Sims, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, shows me around. The school hopes that the buzz of conversation here is about classwork and that students in the Pi Square math zone are collaborating on math. It's a way of keeping students at this engineering and technical school from becoming isolated.
And even though the library is not as quiet as perhaps it was before, they're getting things done.
Like working on projects, which has been shown to keep students engaged and in school. Now, Paul Sims says faculty have always talked about ways to help students succeed, but the new funding formula has made that goal a top priority.
We know it's important. We have always known it's important. And a lot of the things that we are doing in response are things that we had started before because they knew they would be helpful.
The Higher Ed Commission says the funding formula has already resulted in more discussion among colleges about ways to help students complete their degrees. Tennessee Tech has also built classrooms that encourage collaborative learning, and the school is picking up on research that says it makes sense to blend learning and living. All dorms are being turned into learning and living villages. Andrew Smith teaches English, but instead of holding office hours across campus, he now meets students in this dorm known as Treehouse.
Before we had learning villages, we didn't mingle very much. This is where the students lived, and if they wanted to see me, they came to my office on the academic side of campus, and I wouldn't usually come over here. I wouldn't have business over here.
Treehouse is focused on environmental issues. Smith organizes discussion topics and field trips centered on that theme.
The research shows that faculty-student interaction outside of the classroom that is meaningful and substantive changes lives, helps students succeed in the real world.
Now, Tennessee and other states have experimented with performance-based funding before, but many experts say there simply wasn't enough money at stake for schools to make big changes. David Wright with the Higher Ed Commission hopes that with all funding tied to student success, schools will find it very expensive to ignore the issue.
The funding formula itself provides an incentive for campus leaders to take a hard look at which programs are being productive and which ones are not and say, maybe it's not in our best interest to be in the business of this program anymore at this school.
Tennessee Tech has already seen a slight boost in funding because of improvements in student performance, but it will take time to show whether these new programs can make a major dent in college dropout rates. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The presidents of private universities appear to be doing very well. That's according to a new study by the Chronicle of Higher Education. It found 36 university presidents who earned more than $1 million. That was compensation in the year 2009. And the gap between pay for private university presidents and professors is increasing. Jack Stripling co-wrote that story in the Chronicle, where he's a senior reporter, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And this is something the Chronicle reports on annually. So what's changed in numbers for 2009 from numbers in 2008 for university president pay?
Well, this year we found the median total compensation for presidents of private nonprofit institutions was just under $306,000. The increase in terms of a percentage change is rather slight. It's about 2% up from what we recorded last year. We do have 36 presidents making more than $1 million this year as opposed to 33 the year before.
Well, who wins the competition as the highest paid private university president, or at least in 2009?
I don't know if I would define it as winning, but it's $4.9 million that Konstantin Papadakis collected. But he was the president of Drexel University and is now deceased. A big part of the compensation that was recorded this year for him was attributed to a life insurance policy payout for his wife.
To his wife. So who would be the highest paid university president who remained in place?
That would be Nicholas Zepos, who's the president of Vanderbilt University. He collected just under $1.9 million for the 2009 calendar year.
And there's another measure you use, you say, which is this year you also compared university presidents' pay to the pay of professors at their on their campuses. What did you find?
Well, we found that by and large, most presidents make about 3.5 times that of full professors on their campus. At the same time, we found 6 institutions where presidents made more than 10 times that of professors on their campus. The biggest disparity was at Stevenson University in Maryland, where Kevin Manning made 16 times that of professors on his campus. A big part of that was a deferred compensation payout that he received in 2009. But at the same time, even if you looked at him in the year prior, he still made 7 times that of professors on his campus, which was considerably greater than the median.
What did universities tell you when somebody at least answered your questions in defense of pretty high compensation packages?
As you would expect, universities and particularly the boards of trustees that set these compensation levels are wanting to reward what they perceive as great performance. In a lot of cases, the deferred compensation packages come in later in one's career to reward years of service.
And in fairness, the president of a university, unlike the professors, is deeply engaged in raising money for the universities. Part of his job is making money for the institution.
That's right.
Is this a contentious issue on campuses, or do people pretty much accept it?
As you would imagine, any time there is a period of economic difficulty, compensation for executives comes under fire in higher education, just like any other area of the country. And so we've seen at the University of Pennsylvania, for instance, Amy Guttman, one of the higher paid presidents, has been targeted by students on that campus who are members of an offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement. I think we'll see more of that as these data start to become public. Students who are frustrated with tuition rising and other economic problems will look at their presidents and question the level of pay.
Although in the case of Amy Guttman, her pay as a share of the University of Pennsylvania's budget would not be nearly so great as a million-dollar package for someone at a very small college.
That's right. That's right. Now, relative to budget, presidents who make the smallest amount tend to come from the wealthiest institutions, but you can do the math.
Well, Jack Stripling, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Stripling is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's co-author of an analysis of what university presidents at private universities are paid. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. A federal law passed last year requires schools to provide free drinking water at lunchtime. The effort is meant to promote health and fight obesity. Ideally, schools install hydration stations where students fill up reusable bottles with chilled, filtered water. But plenty of schools have to make do with old-fashioned water fountains. Youth Radio's Sarah Cavedo reports that at his high school, where he graduated just last year, few students are lining up to drink.
A couple months before California's new law came into effect, I asked my high school principal, Carmelo Scarlato, what he knew about the mandate to offer free fresh water at lunch.
How aware of SB 1413 are you?
I am not. Excuse me, I am not aware of the bill.
But even after I told him, Scarlato said there are lots of other upgrades that would come before water at our school.
Ventilation, way more important in this building because we have no windows that really open. Repairing leaks to cut down on mold buildup, those are two major areas that I would put money into before water.
Plus, according to both state and federal law, our lunchroom water fountains put my school in compliance with the new water policies. But in the eyes of most students I spoke to, like my friend Jesse Chen, water fountains are nasty.
I wouldn't want to use it.
Why?
Because it's pretty dirty. There's a... I don't know what's in there, but it's pretty bad.
And she's talking about the one working water fountain in the cafeteria, which is covered in stains and which you practically have to make out with to get a drink. Throughout the school, there are signs above most fountains that tell us to run the water for 30 seconds before drinking. And both the custodian and my principal told me janitors run the fountains every morning for 15 minutes to flush the pipes. Makes you wonder how fresh the water really is. I decided to find out.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey,
come on in, guys.
That's Darlene Franklin, a researcher at San Francisco State University.
Of course I expect contaminants. I expect microbes on there, because so many students, I'm sure, probably put their mouth on there.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, all their hands? You never know.
Franklin gives me a bunch of sterile containers, latex gloves, and disinfectant wipes, and shows me how to collect samples.
So, got my two samples from this school, and getting some weird looks from people for talking into a microphone to myself.
A week later, back in Darlene Franklin's lab, we run one last test. After a few minutes fiddling with the microscope, she and her lab partner, Kimberly Suey, finally see something.
Oh, no, no, there they are, there they are.
Good.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm all excited. This is the best part. You get to see them. I got them. They're beautiful.
Kind of beautiful, if you're into that sort of thing. But more to the point, the little yellow blobs are mostly harmless. They're micrococcus colonies from a fountain in my school's hallway. It's a skin bacterium that can, under certain conditions, cause pitted feet. Gross, I know, but safe to drink at the levels we found. And anyway, it's not just the bacteria students worry about.
I hear there's tons of lead in the school's main water system, so I try to shy away from that.
In case this guy, Aiden Offerman, is onto something, we also tested my school's water for lead. All the samples were under the 20 parts per billion that would take it out of service under EPA guidelines. So at my school, at least, we're better off drinking from our rundown fountains than hitting the vending machines for quote-unquote juice drinks. But that's a hard sell, given student perceptions like Issa DeFusco's.
If I was very, very thirsty or felt dizzy, I would probably go and drink some, but I avoid it pretty much at all costs. Honestly, a lot of time at school I'm thirsty and I don't drink water.
And kids aren't totally crazy to worry. Researchers have found elevated lead levels in school districts from Philadelphia to Seattle. And with no federal policy requiring schools like mine to test their water, it's hard for thirsty kids to know whether the supply is safe. So until water fountains, like elevators, get little plaques certifying they pass muster, plenty of students won't trust the free fresh water in their school cafeterias, policy or not. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Cavedo.
That story was produced by Youth Radio.